Ignatius J. Riley stands beneath the clock outside D.H. Holmes' department store in New Orleans, an unmistakable figure in his green hunting cap with his fleshy balloon of a head and bushy mustache. His massive body is draped in plaid flannel, and his haughty demeanor suggests he finds the world beneath his contempt. This 30-year-old medievalist, philosopher, unemployed, living with his mother, and perpetually at odds with everything modern, is about to be thrust into a world he despises. When Officer Mancuso attempts to arrest Ignatius based solely on his bizarre appearance, it sets in motion a chain of events that will upend his carefully isolated existence. His mother, Irene, after drinking too much at the seedy Night of Joy bar, crashes their Plymouth into a building. The resulting financial crisis forces Ignatius, who has spent years in his bedroom writing manifestos and watching television, to seek employment for the first time in his life. What makes Ignatius more than just a comic figure is the glimpses we get of genuine pain beneath his bombast. His father's death, his failure at graduate school, his inability to connect with others, these wounds are real, even if his response to them is absurd. His medievalism isn't just an affectation, it's a desperate attempt to impose order on a world that has rejected him. Imagine being so out of step with your time that you genuinely believe the world took a wrong turn several centuries ago. Wouldn't you also develop elaborate defenses against reality? Ignatius's worldview forms the novel's philosophical backbone, a bizarre amalgamation of medieval Catholic theology, reactionary politics, and personal grievances. He worships Boethius, whose The Consolation of Philosophy becomes his sacred text, using fortune's wheel to absolve himself of responsibility for his failures. In his cluttered bedroom, surrounded by notebooks containing his manifesto, Ignatius has built an intellectual fortress against modernity. His contradictions abound, despising capitalism while consuming its products, criticizing sexuality while secretly lusting after pornography, and championing workers' rights while treating actual workers with contempt. His correspondence with Murda Minkoff, a Jewish activist from New York, reveals their ideological battle of progressive activism versus reactionary medievalism. Despite their opposition, both share a conviction of intellectual superiority. Haven't we all known someone like this? Someone who uses intellect as a shield, constructing theories to avoid painful realities? Toole's genius is creating an Ignatius who remains recognizable despite his extremity. Financial necessity forces Ignatius to seek employment, first at Levy Pants, a declining garment factory. Instead of filing, he launches a crusade to improve working conditions that ends disastrously. His next job, selling hot dogs for Paradise vendors, is equally chaotic. Dressed as a pirate, his own embellishment, he roams the French Quarter consuming his inventory and attracting stray cats with unsanitary practices. Through Gus, he becomes unwittingly entangled in a pornography ring at the Night of Joy bar. These workplace episodes reveal Ignatius's inability to adapt to social norms. Every environment he enters becomes chaotic rather than reformed. His crusades fail because they spring from his grandiose self-image rather than genuine concern. Yet there's something admirable about his refusal to conform. In a world of mindless consumption, his rejection of workplace norms represents resistance, while his failures highlight the compromises most make to function in society. New Orleans emerges as a complex organism with its own personality, not the sanitized tourist version, but a lived-in city of decaying grandeur. The French Quarter's blend of history and tawdriness provides the perfect backdrop for Ignatius's medieval sensibility colliding with modern decadence. The novel captures the city's racial dynamics through Burma Jones, who works at the Night of Joy for slavery wages to avoid vagrancy charges, offering some of the novel's most incisive commentary. Class divisions appear across contrasting neighborhoods, from the Riley's genteel decay to the Levy's suburban prosperity and Santa Battaglia's working class territory. Food establishes New Orleans as a character, with meals reflecting the city's culinary obsession. Most importantly, the novel captures New Orleans' tolerance for eccentricity. In another setting, Ignatius would be institutionalized sooner, but this city accommodates his strangeness, making room for misfits while simultaneously trapping them in its peculiar social web. A Confederacy of Dunces distinguishes itself from typical satire by lacking a moral center. Instead of sympathetic characters guiding our judgment, we encounter a gallery of grotesques, each uniquely flawed, creating a democratic vision of human folly that implicates everyone regardless of background. Irene Riley appears initially as her son's victim, but gradually reveals herself as his enabler. Santa Battaglia's aggressive matchmaking represents another excess, her conventional morality proving as rigid as Ignatius's medievalism. The Levies satire wealthy suburban life through their mutual hostility, while Burma Jones manipulates others in his revenge against Lana Lee. This universal folly connects to the novel's Jonathan Swift title about dunces confederating against genius. Ignatius sees himself as the genius surrounded by dunces, but perhaps we are all dunces forming confederacies against those who threaten our comfortable illusions. Throughout the novel, Ignatius invokes Boethius's concept of fortune's wheel, the idea that fate capriciously raises people up only to cast them down. This medieval philosophy gives him an external explanation for his failures, though most of his misfortunes are self-inflicted through his refusal to adapt. When public humiliation spreads after his Night of Joy disaster, his mother finally reaches her breaking point and plans for his commitment. Simultaneously, Mr. Levy discovers Ignatius's insulting letter to his client. In this crisis, Myrna Minkoff arrives from New York, having sensed through Ignatius's letters that something is wrong. Despite their ideological battles, she represents his only genuine intellectual connection. Their escape in her car, just before the ambulance arrives, provides an ambiguous resolution. The wheel turns for others, too. Burma Jones leverages Lana's illegal activities for better employment, Miss Trixie gets her retirement, and Irene finds potential romance with Claude. These outcomes suggest that while fortune may be capricious, those who take action can succeed, while those who merely complain remain trapped. John Kennedy Toole's life adds profound depth to A Confederacy of Dunces. After rejections led to his suicide in 1969, his mother's persistence reached Walker Percy, securing publication in 1980 and a posthumous Pulitzer Prize. This vindication gives the novel deeper resonance. When Ignatius rails against a world blind to his genius, we hear Toole's frustration with publishers who couldn't recognize his work. The Confederacy of Dunces extends to these real-world gatekeepers. Toole avoids simple author-protagonist identification, portraying Ignatius's flaws with unflinching clarity, perhaps exercising his own problematic aspects while preserving his outsider insights. The tragedy of Toole's suicide contrasts with the novel's ending. While Ignatius escapes with Myrna, Toole found no such escape. His work eventually triumphed, but too late for him to witness. This novel reminds us to make space for the eccentric and misunderstood, suggesting the true dunces may be those who fail to recognize different perspectives' value.